The second and third readings are a very interesting study in contrast. The letter to Philemon, which is, as I said, the text itself has it, probably very, when Paul was very old, is one of the most graceful pieces of literature in the whole New Testament. In fact, it even got canonized, put into the New Testament. It's kind of interesting because what's going on is this. Philemon was a convert of Paul to this Jesus movement. Onesimus was his slave. So, like any sensible slave, he ran away when he got the chance. And being a very canny slave, he ran to Paul. So, Paul writes to Philemon, says, okay, I have your property here. But with this wonderfully graceful, gentle way, he says, but I'm going to send him back to be your brother, not to be your slave. In other words, to radically dispossess yourself of this sense of ownership that you had of another human being. But he does it with consummate gentleness. It's a really wonderful thing. Now, contrast that with stuff like, whoever does not hate father and mother, spouse and children, and even life, cannot be my disciple. Unless you give up all your possessions, you cannot be my disciple. Unless you carry your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. It's extraordinary, I think. It's jarring. What I think is going on is we see Paul, who at the end of his life had come very much to see the costliness of the following of Jesus and turned into this beautifully graceful man, this free person who could write this letter without self-interest. Again, this extraordinarily graceful fashion. What I'm getting at is that is the upshot of really taking these words of Luke quite seriously. Hating father, mother, brother, sister, life, carrying the cross, giving up everything. In other words, we have the fruit of the following of Jesus producing this enormous freedom, which Paul expresses in this little, almost a bread and butter note. Philemon. So Paul's not concerned about himself, and Paul, with consummate gentleness, is concerned about this prior relationship, the condition of Philemon, the condition of Onesimus. But please note, unless you go through this fire of radical dispossession, that freedom is not available. It's really fierce. I think this is a terrifying text myself. And you can't just say, well, that's Mediterranean hyperbole. I mean, they all talk that way, you know. No, it's not. We're talking about a radical shift in one's life, a radical dislocation from the normal human impulse, which is to seek security in all the things that we seek security in, possession, family, status, and root my security in this mysterious figure who is Jesus. So in a kind of abstract way, that's what's at stake here. But then, I don't know, I've been fretting over this all week and saying, well, it sounds so clear. It sounds so persuasive. Hate your father, mother, carry your cross, give up everything. But life is never that clear, I don't think. I mean, we live in a church where it's very hard to find instances of that, it seems to me. I mean, think of yourself. Where do you know anybody in the church who has this kind of freedom, where the security seems to be clearly in God rather than titles, position, power, possessions, blah, 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 the whole long, depressing list of stuff that we human beings erect, construct, invent to support our somewhat fragile sense of who we are and how we are. So where are we? Again, it's always the question, what does it leave us with? What does it leave us with? Is this a council of despair? You just have to go around feeling bad all the time? No, it is a council of hope, and that's why the juxtaposition of the letter to Philemon and this passage from Luke is so interesting, because on the other side of this process, but the result of this process is this kind of freedom, this kind of grace, this kind of sensitivity. But it is, again, to be sought in a profoundly ambiguous world, above all, in a church that's profoundly ambiguous. A church that's constantly in need, as the Second Vatican Council said, a reformation, a reform, and yet steadfastly, so far as I can see, refuses to face the consequences of that injunction. So we got it on the side of the church, and we got it on the side of the world, where you dare not let down your defenses. You dare not make yourself vulnerable to all kinds of things in the world. You dare not be seen as weak, insecure, uncertain about anything. Maybe I've been with adolescents too long, but that's a classic description of what adolescents is. I'm supposed to be an adult, and I look disgustingly like one of those adolescents that I face in class every week. Hope. What this results in, I think, is giving us some idea of the genuine dimension of hope. Of hope. So it's not some vague, well, everything's going to turn out all right. No, 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 no. It makes it quite specific. I must hope for. I must hope to get beyond all the security mongering that is so much of my life. I hope that this God, whom Jesus represents, really will bring me to this freedom. And meanwhile, I really do have to, in the name of integrity, in the name of really wanting to be a Christian, live with this divine insecurity. Because that's what we're really called to. Insecurity what? Because we're not where we are supposed to be. We're not at that state of freedom that Paul seems to achieve. We're not even, I mean, speaking for myself, I'm not even worried about being insecure in that way. That is, I should be insecure about not being insecure. That's what I'm talking about. And to do that in a world which will not tolerate that, that only good defense is a real offense. To do that. That's what we are called to. If we really believe that Jesus is what he's presented as being, this absolute form of humanity.